Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
One short of where we are now, but it's still a better position than it would be with Roy Moore here.
Several legislators ran on the platform of not raising taxes, and I don't think they're going to change their mind. With business community leadership, I hope the voters will vote to raise taxes on themselves.
When he tells me to run because he knows that I have the conservative beliefs and the backbone needed to save his country, that means a lot to me. Trent has apologized for what he did, for what happened. He acknowledged his mistake, and he took full responsibility, and he resigned.
And joining us to talk about the future of Arizona's 8th Congressional District and possibly raising the sales tax to pay for K-12 education, among other topics, are Felicia Rodellini, former Attorney General nominee, and former Superintendent of Public Instruction Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
So, Felicia, because it makes total sense to start with a very conservative district to get your opinion on it, CD8, what do you make of what some people see as chaotic activity there now in the race to replace Trent Franks? We're going to very, very tight deadlines. A lot of Republican candidates have thrown their hats in. And as far as I know, just one Democratic candidate at this point.
Right. And special elections are about low turnout, but also about enthusiasm. And with respect to enthusiasm, the Democrats have the advantage. Everyone knows what my political registration, although I was practicing not saying that. Democrats have a very viable candidate in Dr. Haral Tipernini, a physician, emergency doctor, someone who will inspire voters and women voters. You have to remember that the registration in CD8 may lean Republican, but voter registration shows 41% are registered Republicans, 59% are Democrats, independents, and others. So those voters are enthused. They're enraged. There's a lot of momentum around sexual exploitation and harassment of women. I think those women voters and voters that are independent will come out for someone other than the Republican.
So, Jaime, let's go into the chaotic nature of how many Republicans are in it. And not to disparage anyone who's gotten in, but for a lot of us, Congress still means something. It seems right. Like a lot, even if people don't like what Congress does or doesn't do. a lot of names are current or former lawmakers. Without, again, disparaging anybody, is there anyone who really stands out to you as an exceptional candidate there?
Not yet. They're good candidates. They're credible candidates, no doubt. But if there's anybody that would come in and everybody would say, oh, wow, that's the candidate we got to rally around, no, not yet. There was a great poll that was done recently that showed that Bob Stump probably has the higher name ID, but I think he benefits from a former congressman, Bob Stump, that used to represent that district for a long time. Certainly Debbie Lesko, longtime state senator, very prominent in Arizona politics. So, but it's pretty diverse, and I think it's up for grabs.
Jaime, do you think there is such a candidate out there who would really clear the field and people say, wow, that's the person?
I don't think so. This reminds me of when Trent Franks ran for this seat originally. You had a lot of solid candidates, no standouts. You had Lisa Atkins at the time, Scott Bungard, John Keegan Mayer, and Trent Franks. And I think what's going to happen is the person that can organize, the person that can raise the most money. And with respect to my learned friend here, that I think there is maybe motivation with the Democrats, but there's still no numbers, especially in a special election where you'll be lucky to have a 20% turnout. Lucky to have a 20% turnout. That's where Republicans just overvote in those types of elections. And unless there's a lot of money that gets thrown in by the Democrats, which I see nationally, they're going to be putting in other races where I think they're going to have a very strong contention, and I think they're going to be banking for those kinds of races.
The candidate, Haral Tipernini, has already raised over $200,000, and she has a solid campaign team. A lot of times, folks think that a solid red congressional district is going to attract a Democratic candidate that has no opportunity to win, even because of their background experience. They're not going to be an inspiring candidate. And that's not the case here. We have a woman who will inspire. She's someone who is outside the beltway, outside of politics. Those are the kinds of things that get people out to vote.
Felicia, I think I know how you would answer this, but I'll ask anyway. I'm wondering if you think that given that this is a special election, it will be in the winter next year, not other races going on at that time. We've seen how that has affected some of the special elections earlier this year. Do you think that helps the Democratic candidate? Or do you think maybe, as Jaime's point, that with the turnout being what it probably will be, does that hurt the Democratic candidate?
I think that it's very similar to Doug Jones in Alabama. It was a long shot. Really, no one thought he was going to win. And so I think that the fact that there's no other elections, I believe the Democratic Party nationally will look at picking up another seat. And I think there'll be, it's to the Democrats' advantage. And I'm not saying that just because I believe that and that's my persuasion. I believe that the temperature of the voters is what's going on right now.
But even in the Alabama race, the comparison you use, Doug Jones, yes, he won, but he was also running against a pretty flawed candidate, I think we can all agree with, a pretty substantial amount of baggage. I mean, do you think that the candidates, the Republican candidates, CD8, will be anywhere near that flawed?
Who knows, quite frankly? Who knows?
But I doubt there's going to be somebody charged with pedophilia.
Well,
I mean,
accused of pedophilia.
But that was with credible evidence. I mean, that was, come on, that was a huge, huge handicap. And regardless, I mean, that's what killed the Republican chances. Now, if Luther Strange, remember, who was also a very conservative who ran against Roy Moore, who barely lost, had he won that primary, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
I agree. Luther Strange really had the momentum and was the sitting incumbent as a result of the appointment. Right. So he should have had the opportunity. And that's the reason why it's up for grabs. We don't know.
Jaime, you mentioned Bob Stubbs, you mentioned Debbie Lesko. And one thing I wanted to ask about is Steve Montenegro, as we played in the clip as we started, is proclaiming that it's great that Trent Franks has endorsed him. Is a Trent Franks endorsement kind of like a Joe Arpaio endorsement would be now?
Well, you know, you got to think about it in terms of who are you trying to target? And I think in this case, Steve Montenegro is trying to capture that base. Because if you look back to the percentages of how Trent Franks won, he won with 29% of the vote. Right. In a very similar when you had a lot of different candidates. And those are folks similar to the supporters of Roy Moore that were with him with Haller through Haller high water. You're going to have a situation where you have a lot of Trent Franks followers that believe, well, yeah, he might have done something that may be inappropriate, but I still like him. And they probably would have voted for him again had he decided to stay in Congress. That's where I think Steve is banking on. If I can capture that block. And everybody else is fighting for the rest of that makeup. I think that's a calculated risk on his part.
I wanted to ask a big moral question because I'm big on morals. we hope. Jeff Flake coming out and commenting and also, of course, donating the $100 symbolically to Doug Jones. Are we in a position now where both parties want to win so much? Is there enough leadership from either party to say, okay, no one's perfect? Absolutely. But we want to get people in there that voters can feel good about voting for, as opposed to just winning. Are we moving in that direction, Felicia, or no?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I really can't say affirmatively. I think there is a desire to win at all costs, and we saw that play out in Alabama.
I would say no, and it's unfortunate. And I did this in other media outlets. I lauded Jeff Flake for what he did. I lauded Senator Shelby for what he did. I mean, he was also the U.S. senator that said, I can't vote for Roy Moore. That's the kind of leadership I think this country needs, where people are saying, I'm going to put my country over my party first. And I might be a strong conservative. I might have those feelings of wanting to have that philosophy in leadership moving forward. But if we're going to do that at the expense of our country's moral standing, I don't think it's worth it.
Jaime, how much bigger would you expect the GOP field in that CD8 special election primary to get?
Well, it depends. I think there's a lot of people I know they're making a lot of calls right now.
There's cell towers out in the west side are buzzing right now.
That's right. And there's a lot of polling that's going on right now to see how quickly they can raise the money. And if they think that in this quick of a time that they can get the money, they have enough of a name ID that they can be competitive, and or they have a type of personality that might sell in that district.
How significant will the decision that the Attorney General's office comes up with on whether or not the resign to run law gets triggered by this? How significant will that be?
I think that's very significant. That's a great point. I think that's very significant because right now, most people under the assumption that a lot of especially state legislators would have to resign in order to run for it, which gives a risk, right? You're giving up an assured spot, likely, in order to hopefully get a congressional seat that you probably will be in for a long, long time. So that's the gamble. But if they don't have to resign, then I would suspect a lot of those, the Debbie Lescos, the Kimberly Yees, the even Tony Rivero, again, very credible folks, could say, I don't need to resign. I can go ahead and throw my hat in the ring, gamble, but then I have that fallback position of having my secured legislative seat.
You're almost playing with house money at that point.
Absolutely. And then at that point, because right now you have three candidates that are in officially, I do see that jumping up regardless. But if that were to occur, then I think there it's going to be a free-for-all, at least on the Republican side, maybe a few Democrats. But I really think on the Republican side, it'll be a free-for-all.
Now, Felicia, we've already mentioned Roy Moore, and I wanted to get your take on the fact that a lot of people afterwards were happy to beat up on Steve Bannon afterwards for what happened there. How do you see that affecting the Arizona U.S. Senate race going forward? Obviously, many of us, maybe all of us, expect Kyrsten Sinema to win the Democratic nomination, but on the Republican side, do you think if Martha McSally, when she officially gets in, is Kelly Ward made weaker or stronger by Roy Moore, and how would that affect Sinema potentially?
Oh, Kelly Ward is part of the Bannon camp, and Martha McSally is in the Mitch McConnell camp. So I think it's going to hurt Kelly Ward if she's at the top of the ticket, and Jaime and I were talking about this. It's going to hurt the Republican Party and all of the candidates down ballot.
And so does that mean that Kyrsten Sinema should really, really want to go against Kelly Ward in the general? Many of us assume that, but does Kelly Ward bring a wild card if, in fact, Donald Trump is still with her at that point?
I think Kyrsten can win against anyone. And the more drama and the more controversy that comes up in the Republican primary only helps Kyrsten in her race.
Since we have you here as a Democrat, I did want to ask you, do you think at this point, I mean, you can put sugar on top of this, that's fine. But at this point, are the Democrats really, really counting on Kyrsten Sinema and Greg Stanton? And if those two somehow don't do well, that's a very bad sign for the party.
I would agree. I don't know how I can.
That's an honest answer.
They're very strong candidates in very winnable positions. But this is not a slam dunk year for Democrats at all. It's a test. It's a very important building year for 2020. And it's an opportunity to really show the rest of the United States that Arizona is well on its way to being a purple state. And I think both of those candidates, Kyrsten as well as our buddy...
The mayor.
Yeah. Well, he's going to kill me for not saying his name. Know that. And they have strong teams. They're raising money. They're going to be ready. And I think that it'll be very difficult for anyone to beat them.
Jaime, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, the only thing I would say is that Kelly Ward would be a very difficult candidate for the Republicans. And I think some people have said, well, is it similar to the Trump-Clinton race when Clinton still won in Arizona? But the difference is I think Kyrsten Sinema is very, very well-regarded. I mean, she has a lot of business community support. A lot of Republicans I know think that if it's between her and Kelly Ward, it would be easier, I think. And I think Kyrsten Sinema is really hoping against hope that that's going to be her opponent. However, if Martha McSally or another type of even strong Republican, and I've said even if Andy Biggs were to jump in, I still think Arizona is a very solid Republican state. And I still think that in off-election years, when you have a higher Republican turnout, a strong, credible conservative would have a very high chance of winning, even against somebody like of the stature of Kyrsten Sinema.
Well, hypothetically, if Martha McSally jumps ship from her congressional seat, that makes the opportunity for the Democrats to take that seat back. And Kirkpatrick is ready and is one of the favorites to win the primary down there, and she has done the polling. So I don't know that Martha McSally is ready to abandon that.
Would you advise Ann Kirkpatrick to not do those boot ads again, though?
I am a small-town girl from Sheridan, Wyoming, and I don't think I'm in any position to tell her what to do on her commercials.
That's Felicia Rodellini. Also here is Jaime Molera. We'll continue with our newscap right after this. Good Friday morning. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Here in Phoenix with Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of our newscap with Felicia Rodellini, former Attorney General nominee, and former Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez.
And Jaime, let me start with you. Let's talk about this organization that's been getting together among business leaders in the state talking about what to do about education funding, specifically what's known as Prop 301, which is a 0.6 cent sales tax that pays for education. This group wants to extend it and expand it. The tax is scheduled to expire in a couple of years. This potentially sets up a confrontation, perhaps, with Governor Ducey, who is not a fan of taxes, has vowed to cut them every year he's in office. How, first of all, let's talk about this group, and how realistic do you think it is they would like the legislature to refer this thing to the ballot? Do you have any measure of optimism that would happen?
I don't think so, and I think there's been a little bit of a media hyperbole around this effort because they're saying, well, there's business community is wanting this. Well, it really isn't the business community. When you say business community, there's no major business organization that has said this is something that we should do. These are individuals that certainly are part of a lot of groups, but there are four individuals that have been hyping this, and there hasn't been that groundswell. You know, I was there when Governor Hull did 301. I ran that campaign, and when we did it, it was the business community. It was what I call the Powell Doctrine of overwhelming force. You had a massive influx of dollars. You had every single major business organization and minor business organization come out. You had every major education group come out for it. You just don't have that right now. Now, I think there's going to be a very big discussion of what needs to happen for a number of reasons. 301 is ending in a couple of years, and that's quite a bit of money, about $600 million into the system. You have Prop 123, which is a temporary effort that it's another $300 million. And then you have other dynamics, like the growth of charter schools. Charter schools are paid for 100% by the state general fund. And it's not like with traditional school districts, there's almost a 50-50 split between local property tax and the state backfilling that. The problem is charter schools are growing exponentially. They're the net growth of kids. So over the next 5 years, you're going to have probably another $1 billion into the system from charter school growth. So there's a fiscal tsunami that's approaching us with all of those issues. So I think there's going to need to be a long, hard look on education finance, including what do we do with Prop 301, and I would say what we do with the entire structure of state property taxes that funds education.
Felicia, what do you think that change might look like, or what do you think that conversation might look like?
Well, let me back up for a minute. I need to be clear about why we're in this crisis. And the crisis falls squarely on the shoulders of Governor Ducey. Between his policies, his manipulation of the legal system, the legislative and political system, his tax cuts, and his cowardice in not wanting to talk about raising taxes to have a robust education system. He's the reason why we're here today talking about this current crisis and the fact that we're 51st in education in the United States and territories. So the bottom line here is we don't have a leader, an education leader like we had when we had Governor Hull. And that's an example that I want to bring to the table, is that Governor Hull had the vision, saw what was going on. We needed a 21st century education system. We saw the support of the business community and capitalized that and pushed Prop 301. Governor Ducey could have done that. Instead, we're waiting till 2020, and he's punted to a few members of the business community to initiate this. And it's not well thought of, as Jaime has indicated.
Well, Jaime, is there a fear that by some, and I don't mean, you know, so that some metal hand or so the metal glove is going to come out, but is there a fear of political backlash for some business leaders since the governor has not said he's enthusiastic about this, at least not yet, is there a fear of jumping in too early?
No, I don't. I don't think there's a fear. I disagree a little bit with Felicia in this regard. I think that there has been movement. I mean, people always say, well, the 1-2-3, big deal, that was just nothing. Well, that was an additional $300 million into the system. And then they've added since another about $150 million because now inflationary costs are embedded into the formula, which the governor agreed to, and that was part of the legal deal that was made. And that gets to be minimized. I mean, remember when Fred Duvall ran for governor against Governor Ducey, he said, I'm not going to raise taxes either. I mean, he said that. And if Fred Duvall had won for governor and he proposed that kind of an increase, he'd be lauded by the education community. He'd be lauded by the Democrats saying, see, this is the kind of leadership we want. Look at how much money's been put into the system. But yet the governor has not gotten that credit for that significant gains. But everything I said prior, there's still going to need to be a long-term look on education finance, and there's no doubt about it. I think it's very complex, though. I don't believe it's something that should be rushed into, and I think what the governor has said is that he does want to deal with this, and he does want to bring in business leaders as well as education leaders and look at this in a methodical way.
There's been plenty of opportunities to look at this, and if you go back to August of 2015 and the fact that a Superior Court judge ordered the state to infuse $300 million into education funding at that moment in time. Granted, that was going to be a burden on the budget and on our school funding, but the Prop 123 that came out of that was definitely not the best solution. And it was Governor Ducey manipulating and making sure that public funding was curtailed, it was limited, it was not at the level we needed to fix our classrooms then, and we're at the same place we are now. That's the simple way to look at a very complex issue and a lot of political maneuvering that's happened over the last few years.
Let me ask about the what seemed to be two of the leading options for what to do with this. You either simply extend Prop 301, maybe make it permanent, where mm-hmm. it's at the 0.6%, and what this group of some in the business community are talking about, which is extending it, making it, 1.5 cents per every, per dollar. Mm-hmm. How does one of those seem like it could be the more likely option? I mean, you have two camps that are sort of in one of those options or the other. Maybe does something else emerge, some kind of compromise or something else altogether?
Well, I think there is going to be some kind of a compromise at the end of the day. I think there is consensus, even amongst ardent conservatives in the legislature, that yeah, we probably should continue Prop 301, that needs to happen. Again, ripping out that much money from the system is going to be fairly dramatic if it were not to be continued. So the question is, how much do you ramp it up? And then the other piece is, are you willing to look at the other pieces of the school finance structure? And I would argue, I think we have done quite a bit over these last few years. Remember, Arizona came off probably the worst economic disaster that hit our state during the Great Recession. And we're barely right now exceeding our state budget than we were over 10 years ago. That's how far we came down. So that's what the governors had to deal with. How do you start to really make some progress? And granted, it may not be as quickly as a lot of people would like to see happen, but significant progress has been made. And to your point, Mark, that's where, again, because of all those things that I mentioned earlier, I think there needs to be a comprehensive look that really also takes into account what kind of schools we want, what kind of accountability structure do we want, and do we want to make it meaningful that regardless where a kid goes to school in Arizona, there's going to be a great finance system behind them, and there's going to be strong accountability behind it.
Do you see a difference between how lawmakers might look at the extension of Prop 301 and how some of them looked at enacting or referring to the ballot Prop 100 a few years ago, which was the temporary sales tax for education?
Well, and remember that one, the state
that
budget.
That was a fight.
Well, that was a major fight. And you had to have a governor push it. Governor Brewer, to her credit, right, had to run over the Republican legislature, just like Governor Hull did when we passed Prop 301. People forget we had the same situation. They just didn't want to do it. So I think there is going to be a very there's a big element, let's be honest, that doesn't like taxes. I mean, we know that. We live in Arizona. But the question is, how do you structure it in a way, again, where you have this overwhelming force? Business leaders, education leaders all say, this is what we have to do.
Felicia, let's talk about briefly in the last couple of minutes. So obviously K-12 education funding is going to be a major part of 2018. Legislative races, obviously the governor's race as well. So David Garcia, Steve Farley at this point are the two Democratic gubernatorial candidates. David Garcia ran statewide for superintendent. Now, did not win, but has an education background. Is that going to come into play hugely, what you're saying about what you're claiming is a lack of leadership by Governor Ducey on this?
I think that the education issue is top for 2018. So David deciding not to run for superintendent of public instruction and to run for governor is a good move on his part because he is the education advocate, and he has the background experience to do it. Steve Farley, competent, reasonable businessman, well-known in many respects, has the respect of other leaders and voters already. It's going to be a great primary, which will, of course, raise the profile of the Democratic candidates. Of course, everyone says this is a very difficult race to win. Governor Ducey is a very popular governor for a lot of reasons. And I think that it's just going to be a good year. It's a good year. It better be. It's a backlash year for Democrats. And it's an opportunity for us with a Republican in the White House to really gain some state positions.
Finally, statewide, can Democrats push for an increased sales tax for education when it's such a regressive tax in many ways? Is that not a good game for Democrats to play?
I think it's worth the risk.
Well, and people forget Prop 301 also has an element that allows for those below a certain income threshold to get a tax credit. And those are the pieces that people don't understand. 301 is a very complex structure, but it did take into account tax regressivity.
That's former Superintendent of Public Instruction Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. Also with us was Felicia Rodolini, former Attorney General nominee. Guys, thanks for joining us on the Newscast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.